You know, I'm finding it really difficult to move the microphone back to myself in order to say the name of the show in a timely fashion. Well, like, there's dead air that I intend and dead air that I don't intend.
Well, maybe we should put it on a caster or something so it will glide across the table that. More easily.
Linoleum Knife, a podcast of the cinema.
A podcast of the cinema that is now legal in 50 states. I'm sorry, it was okay, Friday, but I'm still excited.
So here's the problem.
Yes, there's a problem to this?
You know what the problem is. The downstairs dogs that yap their heads off all day long, we were promised they would be moved by
this
today.
This week,
and they are still here.
They are.
They just yapped at us as we walked in. And it was my understanding that on Friday, the Supreme Court of the United States of America promised me no more problems ever for the rest of my life.
As it turns out, however,
I would like a recount. Because I was promised smooth sailing from here on out.
Yeah, it's not how it works.
And those dogs are still in my way. They're in the way of my ears and in my sanity.
Friday was one step toward a total victory and equality and dog-freeness, and we're not there yet. But the fight continues, but we celebrate our victories as they occur. I'm Alonzo Duraldi, the film reviews editor for The Wrap and a film critic for What the Flick on the Young Turks Network on YouTube.
I'm whatever. Oh, I'm Dave White.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm Dave White. I am also the film critic of... No, wait. I am a film critic as well, just like you. I am the film critic for linoleum-knife.com.
Yes, you are.
Always remember the dash.
Yes.
Never forget the dash. If you forget the dash, you go to a site that is about nothing.
Although somebody bought that site out from under us.
Yeah, but it's still
us,
about nothing.
True, but they might turn it into a site of knives. I don't know what it's going to be.
Well, that would be great. We could buy knives... We could buy linoleum knives there as premiums to guests.
I will buy linoleum knives elsewhere. I'm not giving money to the people who took our URL that is rightfully ours because I said so.
I believe that the Supreme Court on Friday was supposed to make the internet perfect for us
as well. Yes, I know. It's one disappointment
I got to tell you, this is a Pyrrhic victory, really.
I was very
impressed. Did I just pop my
no,
pee
you
there?
Did not,
are you
no.
sure? Okay.
No, I don't think so.
Pyrrhic.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was impressed by your use of the word myriad.
Google that one.
Pyrrhic.
Okay, so here's the thing that I've noticed lately. You and I have been taking so much of our sweet time getting to the reviews.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the thing that some people love and other people complain about quite a bit and stop listening over is the fact that we just yammer for 10 to 15 to 20 minutes before we get to the reviews. Maybe this week we should mix it up. Well, maybe we should get right into the
movie.
You
know, I think folks like to pull up a chair to the old Cracker Barrel and hear what we have to say on the front porch while we're whittling a spell. We could do that.
Having some lemonade?
Mm.
I just saw a recipe for a new lemonade. Brand new lemonade.
Oh, ooh.
They're calling
it a new concept in lemonade?
They're calling it nose-to-tail lemonade.
Uh-huh.
You put the whole lemon in the lemonade.
Uh-huh. And?
Like, you chop it up.
Right. Peel
it
off.
Well, first of all, you get all the lemon zest off it.
I see.
And then you chop it up and get the seeds out.
Okay.
Okay. And then you put the whole thing and the zest in the blender with the water and the sugar.
Ooh.
And it becomes
super tart.
The most pulpy of all pulpy lemonades because genuinely what you're then getting is everything.
Oh, man, you got to make those.
I think I'm going to.
And even better, you could, like, if we could turn it into popsicles. When it is 10,000 degrees outside.
And then somehow sprinkle it on a lemon cake.
When it is 10,000 degrees outside and we have no air conditioning in this apartment, we can have popsicle pulpy lemonade.
Yeah.
Yum.
That's a good idea.
It's a really good
idea. A better idea? Air conditioning.
Well, sure, yes. But
the global, the climate change is, it's just a ticking hot bomb. We're doomed. Yeah. Like we have,
and our carbon footprint is tiny.
Minimal. We have lived without air conditioning for 16 years.
16 years.
Because our this side of the hill has traditionally not needed it. We're on the ocean side. But it's only June.
Yeah.
And it's already
a little sticky.
Making me not happy.
Yeah. And when we say the ocean side,
it's not how it's supposed to be in Los Angeles.
We don't mean like you can see the ocean from our apartment or anything.
Right.
But we're just like, as opposed to being in the valley, basically.
Correct. But we still get the ocean breeze.
Right.
They don't. Mm-hmm. And
we still get the breezes.
I'm kind of, you know how sweaty I get. I don't like to be touched. Hot.
Oh, I'm aware.
It's hot. Everything's hot. In the wintertime, I don't like to be touched.
No, it's true.
I get hot. I'm like, this is...
There's a constant furnace inside you.
That marital cuddling thing is like... I know we're legal in all 50 states now, but you get like 3 minutes of that with me.
I know.
And then I'm like, okay, you're making me sweat.
Unless we go to the ice hotel in Norway.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know. It's a limited time offer.
I'll give you all the marital cuddling you need at the ice hotel. That will be fine.
You in the ice
hotel. I'll be in a t-shirt. You'll be in a parka.
You in the ice hotel would be like the lady in the Jack in the Box commercial with the jalapeno thing, making everything melt.
Yeah.
Because you just are constant, you're at this constant lizard temperature, or whatever the opposite of
whatever
that is.
Whatever the opposite of that is. I need to be in a cold room, like 45 degrees. I'll be preserved at that temperature. At all other temperatures, I'm rotting from the inside.
Look, we established that your dream job would have been butcher.
Butcher.
You should have apprenticed when you were young and strong and could carry around those sides of beef.
Yeah, now I'm an old, broken down old man.
You are broke down.
What are two movies?
Well, the only one that we both saw was Ted 2.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, you didn't see Max.
Nope. And you didn't see The Tribe.
I didn't see The Tribe. Well, can we wait and talk about The Tribe later when I've seen it? Because I'm going to go see it this week at CineFamily. Yeah, that's a great idea.
No, but it's out now in some places. And
right.
It's not like there's much else to talk about this week.
Okay. Talk about The Tribe.
I will talk about The Tribe,
Talk about The Tribe right now.
All right, fine.
Do it.
I don't have the guy's name in front of me. It's a mouthful. Ukrainian director.
I'm going to look it up.
And this is a film that is set in a home for the deaf. It's like all sort of high school age, teenagers. And
like what kind of home? Like an orphanage?
Kind of, yeah. Well, I mean, here's the thing. This movie has no dialogue. Everything is communicated between characters in sign language, and there are no subtitles.
Written and directed by Miroslav Slaboshpitsky,
right.
Yeah.
So you're kind of on your own as far as figuring out like why anyone is there, what their backstory is, they have families. We don't know.
Right.
Ultimately, doesn't matter.
Right.
So we first see this guy get off the bus and sort of get somebody points their way to the thing, and he shows up in the middle of some sort of ceremony, and everything seems all very official, and there's lots of like cute little girls giving flowers to dignitaries and blah blah blah.
Right.
Very soon, however, we discover that no, this is actually the Lord of the Flies. There's a criminal enterprise going on, and everybody's violent, and there's like these two female students that are sort of being pimped out by the junior goon students who themselves are sort of working for these two deaf gangsters.
Right.
Anyway, so the movie has like very long takes, very sort of wide static shots. I mean, there's a lot happening within the frame, but the camera's not moving.
Right.
And again, you don't know anybody's name. You don't know where they came from. No one talks, they're talking a mile a minute to each other, but you don't understand any of it. You have to kind of piece it all together through, context and facial expressions and whatnot.
Yeah.
It's riveting. It is one of my favorite movies this year. This movie it's dark and it is messed up and it will take you to some uncomfortable places. But the storytelling is so sure-handed and just really fascinating to kind of get into. you know, Drafthouse is releasing it. I don't know how much of a theatrical footprint it's going to have, but this is the textbook example of a movie you should really see in a theater, because you really need that dark room, that level of concentration, that phone off, really immersion to follow what's going on. And the movie pays off. It makes it worthwhile. It's whatever effort you put into it is very much rewarded by how great it is.
But I will understand it.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, I'm going to go.
Look, you are the one that goes to the Hao Xiaoxian movies. So, If you can follow the 10-minute shots of, you know, people arguing about revolutionary politics around a table or whatever, I'm sure you can follow what's going on in this movie.
I'm quite intelligent.
Yes.
As I think we all
do. You enjoy...
We all understand
you
this.
Enjoy a rigorous...
About me.
...cinematic experience. Yeah. This will be right up your alley. No, I was on a jury last fall at AFI. We gave it an award, and I immediately thought, this is so a Dave White movie.
Didn't you show this to your class?
I did, yeah.
Was there a guest?
No, sadly, no. I couldn't get anybody. I think the filmmaker was here like a week or two ago with one of the actresses to do like a press day.
Right.
But no, I showed it without a guest, but they were into it.
The students were into it.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, cool. They thought it was intense and dark, but they liked it. And we talked a lot about it and, you know, what they were able to follow and where they would occasionally get lost and that kind of thing. And, you know, because this class that I'm teaching is about, you know, creative problem solving. And yeah, so to do an entire film with dialogue that no one in the audience pretty much can understand. Because I think even if you speak ASL...
Yes.
You know, I'm sure whatever they speak in the Ukraine is totally different.
So it was like...
It's Ukrainian sign.
Russian or whatever, Ukrainian
Yeah, whatever sign. It is they speak there. Or they sign there.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, because, you know, I mean, even between ASL and British Sign Language have their differences.
I see.
I told you this story.
You would
think
it would be universal, though. Shouldn't it be kind
there
of like an Esperanto
sign language? Yeah, you'd think, but no. Yeah. I told you that story. I was in a play years ago in Dallas.
Yeah.
About Alan Turing, actually.
Yeah.
Breaking the Code, and the ASL interpreter had a hard time figuring out what the word for bloody was. Because when the British say it, it means one thing.
It's a slang.
Yeah. Yeah. And in ASL, you know, she didn't want to say like sanguine, you know,
right.
Whatever.
No,
so,
of course.
So, yeah. So I think, you know, unless you are a Ukrainian deaf person, you are not going to understand the signing that is happening on screen.
I get it.
So the movie has to have other ways for you to figure out what's going on. And yeah, it's great. It is great, great, great.
Well, you know, not great. Is Max?
I didn't go. I went on Wednesday night to see Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory at the Orpheum as part of the LA Conservancy's Last Remaining Seats thing, which was I had a great time. Although the print was not great.
It was a 35.
It was 35. Yeah. It was a 96 reissue print from when we saw it for the 25th anniversary.
It wasn't like pink or anything.
No, but it was
a little worn.
There were some snips. There were some like occasional lines that were missing because of a cut, you know, and some of the real changes were a little scratchy.
Did people shout out the lines that were missing?
No, but I'm sure we all thought them in our heads. I know I did.
What was missing that you remember?
I don't remember now, but there's one of the lines were like when they're walking into the inventing room or something, one of the uh-huh. last things that Wonka says at some point, like it was just gone. I sort of mentally filled it in. But it was fun. I mean, Last Remaining Seats is this cool thing they do in Los Angeles where the LA Conservancy, who they don't own any buildings, but they do a lot of preservation work and work to make sure that
right.
they're the ones who kept norms on La Cienega from getting torn
yes.
down.
Yes.
You know, which is this great sort of example of googie architecture.
Right.
They do a summer series where they show films in all of the downtown theaters.
Right.
And so you have theaters like the Orpheum, which is, and the Ace now, which are both privately owned and have been completely renovated and are you know, pretty much state of the art theaters, but still sort of maintain a lot of their old classic architecture from the 1920s.
Yeah.
And then other ones that are still in various stages of disrepair.
Of being busted.
Yeah, like the Los Angeles or the Million Dollar, but they're in good enough shape that you can go and see a movie there.
Right.
And so it's a great way to sort of call attention to these amazing, you know, architectural landmarks that we have downtown.
Theaters.
Yeah, I mean, this was really back in the day when movie theaters were cathedrals. You
right.
know? And so I like to go at least once a year. It's, you know, it always happens right up, butting up into Outfest, since I don't have a lot of time, and it's, you know, weeknights when I've got to go see other movies. But so yeah, so I went to see Willy Wonka, which was great, but it meant I'm not going to see Max. So
okay, so there's this dog. He is not a German Shepherd.
Okay,
he is a Belgian Malinois. Did you know what that was?
Spell that, please.
Malinois.
Okay.
Yeah. I didn't know this was a breed.
Mm,
they look like German Shepherds.
Yeah.
Except they have black snouts.
Okay.
And often that color, that black, goes like all the way up to their eyes.
Hmm.
This particular dog that plays Max, his name is Carlos. He's a newcomer. He's a debut doggy actor.
And there's only one dog in the movie?
No.
Ah.
Well, yes.
Well, I want to say there's only one dog playing Max, is my question.
There's only one Max, but there are six dogs playing Max, depending on what's happening.
That was my question. Because I know, like, the Lassie that we liked from a few years ago had three Lassies.
Yeah. So here's what they do, right? This is not related. This is not about the movie. This is just about the function of how you get a dog performance out of a dog.
Snossages.
They needed a dog. They needed that breed, because that's the breed that is often used as military working dogs, and that is what he is.
For bomb sniffing?
For everything.
Oh.
Yeah. And so they often use the Belgian Malinois as military working dogs because they are highly energetic.
Okay.
And they don't tire easily, and they respond well to really rigid training. But for the sake of the camera, they needed one whose eyes you could see. And when you have a black snout and a black face, eyes sort of sink
disappear,
in.
Disappear, yeah.
Yeah. And the... so they had to get... They found one. First of all, they didn't just need to find one that didn't have so much black on the snout. They needed to find one that was kind of chill. So they hunted around. They found one. Mm-hmm. They found one who had a little more brown around the eyes so that his eyes could pop for the camera.
Right.
And he could be calm and sit still and be, you know, and be trained and look expressive and sad into the camera. Because first of all, this is a beautiful dog that they found. This dog is like Cary Grant and Robert Mitchum and Chris Hemsworth
dogs.
And Grace Kelly. Like a little bit of that. Like, but a dog. This dog is gorgeous. Like, you're watching this dog. You know, like the handsome gorilla that they've been talking about this week?
Oh, right, yeah.
The big meaty muscular with the handsome face gorilla that apparently is driving Japanese tourists
into a frenzy
of adoration. Because it's at a zoo in Japan. This dog is so gorgeous that, and so sweet and so expressive that even though this is not a good movie, if you're totally into dogs, you should go see it. And I don't want to give you a spoiler, but the thing that people don't want to go see dog movies over, the reason a lot of people don't want to go see dog movies is because they're afraid that something very, 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 very bad is going to happen to the dog. For example, such as in Old Yeller or Marley and Me.
Or White God.
Or, all the dogs in White God. You don't necessarily have to worry about that with Max.
Okay.
So that's as close as I'm going to get to a spoiler about Max. But you can rest easy that you're not going to get ultimate tragedies.
Ingu used the phrase Disney Channel movie.
Well, yeah. Okay, so here we go. Anyway, for the stunt Maxes, the hyper ones that fight and jump and leap and soar and do all the hero stuff, that run and run and run and run and run and run and run, they got like five stunt dogs. And they each had to be made up.
I was going to say.
To have less dark snouts.
When you were talking about the color thing, I was like, is there not a dog stylist that can come in?
There was and a give dog a stylist. A dog stylist came in to give him a little, like.
Where'd you hear all this?
I read about it
on
the internet.
I see.
Where the information is.
Ah.
Yeah. Because I was curious, like, how many dogs was it? What did they do?
And you're clearly more interested in the mechanics of making this movie than talking about the actual film.
The mechanics of it is so much more interesting than the film. The film is, okay, here's what happens. Robbie Amell,
right.
who is on The Flash.
Yeah, he's half of Firestorm.
And he was the romantic lead in The Duff.
Right.
Yeah. He's a soldier in Afghanistan, and Max is his MWD, all right, his military working dog.
Oh,
and so they're tight. They're, he trained him. They're very close. And Max has a childhood friend who's also in Afghanistan. He's also a soldier. His name is
wait. Max is
not
the dog,
Max.
Right?
I'm sorry, Robbie Amell, who plays a guy named Kyle.
Gotcha.
Kyle has a friend. That was my mistake. Kyle has a childhood friend who's also in the military with him, and they're in the same unit, and blah blah blah. And I forget his name, but we'll just call him Evil Bad Person. Okay. So, Evil Bad Person. Max does not like Evil Bad Person ever, even when they're in the war together. Mm-hmm. And you know this. Because the camera will never stop showing you connective tissue between Evil Bad Person and Max. So every time you see Evil Bad Person, you see there's a shot of Max looking at him, staring at
not
him.
Not snarling, just
giving him the eye.
Gotcha.
The doggy eye.
Right.
Okay, so Robbie Amell is blown up. And so the dog, because of this, has PTSD, and they put him in a military dog pound, and they're gonna put him down because he's fit for nothing now.
Yeah,
right. I guarantee you that happens to lots of those dogs. I mean, this is a thing we never talk about, I guess, but this is obviously.
I didn't even know there were dogs that went to war. So I guess there would be dogs that go to war and get put down.
That must be a thing that happens. So in comes Robbie Amell's family. His father is Thomas Hayden Church, who plays an ex-Marine. His mother is Lauren Graham, who has gone super method for this movie. It's set in Texas, so she says things like, "I'm fixing to make y'all some casserole," and I'm like, Lorelai Gilmore, that's not how you talk.
I remember in the trailers being like, "Oh, honey,"
yeah, and I'm like, "What's happening?" Also, they've really mommed her up. Like, they've given her, like, a little puffier hair. It looks like she maybe intentionally gained, like, 15 or 20 pounds.
They like, give her a little hip padding or
something? Yeah, it seems like they've got her padding, or they've got, like, extra stuff on her face. Like, it's this fuller, matronly look that she's got going on, which I was just fascinated by, because I was like, this is some Charlize Theron and Monster kind of thing. Like, you gain some weight to play the mom. And then you go back to being like skinny
actress,
little Lauren Graham. Yeah. So they have a kid. They have a younger boy who's sullen and a teenager and grumpy and he's mad. He's mad about everything.
Right.
You know? And he has no respect for nothing. No respect for nothing. Yeah. So Max comes back. Like they give Max to the family because the family's like, "Don't kill him. Let us try." So the kid has a bond with Max. Like, Max immediately goes to the kid and is like, "You're my new daddy." And so the kid trains him. And it's, small town Texas, so it's very sweet and pastoral. And it's filmed in North Carolina, so it has literally, visually nothing to do with what Texas actually looks like. But, they've got, these really well decorated 4th of July parades. The whole town is
everything's green and lush.
Yeah.
Small town Texas looks like the Last Picture Show.
There's like a river near the town, a little waterfall. I'm like, I never saw anything like that in Texas. I mean, outside of Austin, there's
maybe
hills,
like Travis,
like East Texas. There's some of that little bit, but just not much.
A lot of scrub there.
So. Into the small Texas town comes the black market weapons trade.
It's in tiny towns everywhere.
Evil Bad Person is part of it.
But he's from there, though, right?
He's from the town. Well,
so, of course, and if you go into the black market weapons trade, you bring it back to where you are were born.
And he got a dishonorable discharge, and so he's, for we can't remember now, I can't remember now what reason, but he lies to everybody and tells him he's injured. Uh-huh. The dog, always Max always snarls at him when he's nearby. Mm-hmm. You see these really hilariously framed shots of evil bad person sort of glaring at Max through windows and stuff like that.
Boy.
Yeah. And then Max brings down the black market arms trade.
Okay.
The end.
The end.
Oh, yeah. But with him, he has some help from Thomas Hayden Church, who has one leg. Well, he has a prosthetic.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. His second leg is a prosthetic. And because he was a Marine, he got his leg.
In what, Desert Storm?
In Desert Storm. Okay. Yeah. And then also the boy, the young teenage boy and his two BMX bike friends. So there's three kids on BMX bikes and the dog and Thomas Hayden Church. And they take down the black market weapons train. Mm. This is a movie for children.
PG or PG-13?
Oh, PG all the way. Okay. This is the black market weapons people don't swear.
Ah.
And they're easily vanquished. Like, you can, like, it's a that darn cat kind of scenario where, like, you know, they're menacing, but they can also be easily like pushed over, you know.
So like if this were
knocked down a hill.
If this were like one of the Dexter
Riley,
if this were one of the Dexter Riley movies, that I'd be wearing like slightly oversized gangster suits.
Kinda, yeah, okay. Yeah.
Is this one of those deals where evil childhood friend is the only white one?
There's a corrupt walking tall style sheriff.
Ah, okay.
I said that in the review I'm currently still in the middle of writing. This is Walking Tall for kids.
Oh, well, yeah. Okay, great.
And there's a white sheriff who's one of the other bad guy, but all the drug cartel people who are buying the weapons, they're all Mexican.
Of course.
Yeah, because, you know,
Texas.
Because Texas, yeah. And everyone's got a gun. Like, all the good people in the movie, they all got guns, and they all had to use them against the bad guys. Because, like, you know.
Good guy with a gun.
All you need is a good guy with a gun.
Yes.
To make
sure.
And a military working dog.
That, well,
with
that,
PTSD.
That helps, definitely.
I'll tell you, this dog is really nice. Like, I'm really into this dog.
Mm.
And as I watched it, I thought, this movie's stupid.
That dog's a star.
That dog is a star. Yeah, it is. It is all the kinds of kitsch that it can be. It's family kitsch. It's patriotism kitsch. Mm. It's wartime kitsch. It's doggy hero kitsch. It's all the kitsches wrapped into one big kitsch witch.
So I'm sure the pitch was like, it's American Sniper with Rin Tin Tin.
Yeah, pretty much. So yeah, it sucks. Bring the kids.
Also sucking, but do not bring the kids, is Ted 2.
Can you imagine? Like, bring a 9-year-old.
Oh, God.
Mommy, what's a...
Well, the 9-year-old will probably laugh the hardest of anyone. Because it's aimed right at him. And I have to say, I liked the first Ted. I mean, there were... But I realized that it's one of those movies where I laughed enough times and so frequently and so heartily that I was willing to overlook a lot of problems.
It's total uselessness.
That and it's creepy sexism. And this movie did not make me laugh enough to overlook all the things that are wrong with it, especially...
Boy, there's some things wrong with it.
Yeah. For starters, Seth MacFarlane does not know how to do, like, a feature film story start to finish with any kind of structure. I mean, you know, people think that you can just make a comedy...
From thing to thing to thing.
Yeah,
the
comedy's just like, blah, 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 blah. Right. Like, no, if you look at the great comedies, if you look at a movie like Airplane, even, that seems anarchic, there's a framework there, you know, on which to hang your stuff. And with MacFarlane, it's all stuff and nothing to hang it on.
Right.
Which is why I like watching 30-second clips of Family Guy on YouTube, but can't make it through an entire episode.
Yeah, exactly.
This is that the movie.
So Ted marries Tammy Lynn.
Right.
Who plays her?
I do not know.
Wait. Talk more about
Wesley Morris wrote in Grantland, her Boston accent trucked up the I-95 from Queens.
Well, yeah.
Okay.
Her accent is all over the place, but she's kind of funny.
She's game. I definitely, I'll give her that.
She's down, and, she's know, down for
she's
it.
She's down for the ridiculousness of it all.
She's been in a lot of stuff, too.
So
her name is Jessica Barth.
Jessica Barth.
So Bart. Mm, like Roland.
Right, right. Well, it's not B-A-R-T-H-E-S, right?
You know, maybe she dropped the S.
Well,
maybe she didn't want to show up her more famous relative.
Maybe she's the daughter of Barth from You Can't Do That on Television. Anyway, Ted gets married to Tammy Lynn, and Mark Wahlberg is sad because Mila Kunis has divorced him, and then Ted and Tammy Lynn start arguing a lot, and a coworker suggests that they should have children. So, of course, since Ted has no genitalia, much less testes, he asks, well, first he tries to steal semen from Tom Brady, and then when that doesn't work...
I like that part.
That was kind of funny. And then when that doesn't work, he tries to get Mark Wahlberg to make a donation, which then, of course, leads to wacky sperm bank hijinks that you probably saw in the Red Band trailer. And then it turns out that Tammy Lynn's insides are a rocky place where no one's seed will find any purchase. So
thanks, structuralism.
Yeah. I don't even...
Roland Barthes.
Oh, shut up. So then they try to adopt, and when they try to adopt, it is pointed out that Ted is not a person, and he is technically property. And so he has to go to court to prove that he has a soul, and that involves getting newbie lawyer Amanda Seyfried on the case, who likes to smoke a lot of weed but doesn't get any of the pop culture references that the two of them are always saying. So, of course, they call her Gollum over and over again.
Yeah.
So they managed to drag Giovanni Ribisi back into this for no good reason. Hasbro allowed its name to be used, even though the company is being constantly portrayed as evil and conniving.
Evil, yeah.
Like, I kept waiting for the punchline of where somebody from the company was going to disavow the whole thing, but nope, they just, Mark Wahlberg is the Transformers guy now, Hasbro it is.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
It's bizarre.
Can you say that again, just like that?
Bizarre.
All right. First of all, this is just a terribly made film.
Yeah,
it is. It looks terrible. It is.
There is one elaborate opening musical number,
the Busby Berkeley dance sequence at the beginning, Busby Berkeley style. Let's say it is not anywhere nearly. It's not anywhere near as inventive as a Busby Berkeley.
No.
Choreographed sequence, but the rest of the film is, let's call it ugly.
Sure.
It is cinematically ugly. It doesn't look good. It doesn't move well. There's nothing visual to rest your eyes on and go, oh gosh, look at that. It is a bad looking film.
Even when they crash a car and spend the night in this like bucolic field next to a barn, it looks like the weirdly green screenish, and it's a sequence that goes on forever
for a very long time, just so that Amanda Seyfried can sing.
Yeah, the movie's almost 2 hours long.
Yeah, so there's that. So it's a badly made film.
Mm.
And now, I would like to talk about the problem of the script.
Please do.
There are discrete. And by discrete, I mean discrete, discrete jokes in the film that are very funny.
Yes, like those 30-second Family Guy YouTube clips.
I laughed many times.
Me too.
During the course of this film. But then, in between those discrete laughs, there is a lot of dead air.
Mm.
And
which gives you time to reflect.
Which gives you time to think about the weird problem this film has with race and with its own ideas about satire. So, Seth MacFarlane clearly has an obsession with jokes about black men and their genitals.
Mm.
Furthermore, he has an obsession with the silliness of painting Ted as the equivalent of a black man sold into slavery 200 years ago.
Like, Dred Scott and Plessy versus Ferguson are cited on multiple Roots occasions.
Roots comes up, and Ted says the scene where Kunta Kinte is being whipped until he
says Toby.
Says Toby. Ted says, "Yeah, that's just like me."
Yeah, and that's
the
thing.
And Mark Wahlberg is like, "Not really," but that's it. Like, the movie never calls Ted and lets him know that, "Oh yeah, dummy, that's not like you."
Like, for that joke to work, and it could work under circumstances where it's very clear that the movie knows that the character is saying something ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah.
But because this movie is so weird about what it has to say about black men and about other sort of racial issues, you don't know if they know that he's saying something ridiculous.
The point of view is completely screwed up. You are meant to always be on Ted's side, no matter what. And even in his abject stupidity. And so, because he's somehow good at art, I think Seth MacFarlane wants you to think that this film is a satire about race or about gay marriage, even, because there's so much about, you know, you can be married, but you're not a person. No, you can't be married. We're annulling your marriage.
Right.
But the movie is so invested in the joke at all costs that it never gets to the satire.
Right.
If it ever had that in its pack,
in its sights,
in the first place. And so it has no allegiance to anyone or anything other than, hey, isn't this funny? Ooh, aren't we naughty? And so
it's a bit of a shambles, and it would,
like the inner kids, like the internet kids say, problematic.
I think that MacFarlane strikes me as somebody who is great in a writer's room.
Right.
Like, if you need somebody to fill in...
You need a gag here,
he's got them. Yes.
Yeah.
But then you have somebody else who's the architect, you know, who actually structures this thing and makes the characters and figures out what the story is and what the movie's trying to say and how it's going to say it. And then MacFarlane come in and put in his little, you know, wherever he wants to.
Right.
But it's just MacFarlane and his flunkies, you know, and so you get this, and it's a mess.
The characters contradict themselves from scene to scene in terms of what they find okay to say and do versus what they find okay for others to say and do.
Uh-huh.
You know, like the grocery store clerk who explains slavery to him.
Right.
Coco Brown.
Oh, is that Coco Brown?
That's Coco Brown.
Oh, okay, yeah. From Single Moms Club.
And she calls the white people
white N-words.
That N-word, yes, that's not nice to say. And
And
Ted looks right at her and says, "Hey, is that okay?" Like, and I'm like, "Well, Yeah, it's okay because you're in this weird universe where nothing matters."
Well, Wesley Morris is, they bring her out early to say that word to then numb us to the rest of the movie.
Oh, I got to read his review. Yeah. That is the effect. You're supposed to say, "Oh, well, that black woman just said this thing, so he can talk about him. He can talk about being just like Kunta Kinte, and every other black actor in the film, Morgan Freeman, Dennis Haysbert, you know, they can come along and lend an air of, well, we're black, so this is okay."
Exactly.
And it's a big mess of contradictory elements. It ain't good.
Yeah,
you know, you're gonna laugh if you are of the bong type of person. You're gonna forgive it a whole bunch,
but then
more
you'll
than
laugh
you
at,
would.
You'll laugh at anything,
right? And so, like I said, there are plenty of individual jokes in the film that are funny, but they have nothing to do with this other stuff, and they don't tie into the other stuff, and the other stuff is really weird and a problem.
Yeah. What's your DVD pick?
Well, I watched a DVD last night. I watched Pride.
Mm.
Been out on DVD for a while, but I decided I was going to attack Mount Unwatched. And I watched Pride. You know, because of gay. It's the gay weekend.
Woo!
And this is about the 1984 miner strike and the gays who helped the miners.
Right.
Which is a real thing that happened in England. And it's an incredibly too long movie.
Yeah, it's because it's based on a true story.
Way too many characters and way too many things happening. And,
they shoehorn a lot in there.
And way too many intentional moments where they're kind of jabbing you with the crying stick.
Mm-hmm.
So the here's what I liked. I like the part where they all stop and they sing the Bread and Roses song.
Yeah,
that was very
scene.
Sweet. I liked Billy Bragg singing at the end.
Mm-hmm. There's power in a union.
Yeah, I like this movie because it's about unions.
Yeah,
and how good unions are.
And that
we don't hear that enough at all.
Yeah,
anymore.
No kidding. I mean, the wealthy in this country have done everything possible to reverse the last 100 years of progress,
right?
And put the working class back to where they were, you know, like in serfdom essentially.
But my pick of the week is The Decline Box.
Yes,
The Decline of Western Civilization. And The Decline of Western Civilization, Part 2, The Metal Years,
mm-hmm.
and Decline of Western Civilization 3, which maybe has a semicolon, maybe has a
I
colon,
don't know that it has a
something,
metal.
Something, gutter punks are homeless and sad,
yeah,
is that the semicolon?
Something like that, yeah.
Or the colon, I keep saying semicolon.
We went to see Decline 1 this week at the Arclight, which
Arclight.
I had never seen.
You had never seen it, and it was a film in the 80s for me that was very instructive.
I'm sure.
It helped me understand exactly what I was. I was an 80s punk rocker.
You were a punker.
I was a yes. And I was a Mama's Family punker.
And I think of you more as a Quincy.
Yeah. So the very few people are going to get what we're talking about.
In the 80s, there were certain episodes, certain TV series that had the requisite punk episode.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
WKRP had one. Chips had one.
Chips.
The one that most people talk about are the Mama's Family or the Quincy episodes.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, this is a really great movie. It's this really great time capsule of that moment.
It's really lean. It was not what I was expecting it to be.
What did you think it was going to
I
be?
I thought it was going to be sort of, well, I mean, I had seen Decline 2, where they really kind of cover the L.A. scene.
Yes.
And they talk to a lot of different people, and you talk to a lot of nightclub owners, and just folks who are in the audience and stuff, and wannabes and that kind of thing. And it felt like it covered broader terrain, whereas
yes.
This is almost like a concert film with some interviews.
Yes.
You know, so they focus on, what, 5 or 6 bands?
There's like 7 or 8 bands.
And yeah. You see them do like 2 songs yeah. each, and then some of them
Fear,
you get...
Black Flag, Circle Jerks,
Germs, Alice Bag Band.
Alice Bag, Catholic Discipline, and I forget.
Anyway, so like some of them you get to meet backstage or, you know, in their apartment. Penelope Spheeris loves to film people making eggs.
Yes.
Darby Crash does it in this one. I forget who does it in 2. And then, you know, some of the bands you don't meet backstage at all. And then it's over. Like I thought, oh, yeah. Okay, well, that's it then. And I have to say, I was kind of scared of that movie for a long time. I mean, that poster of like Darby Crash lying on the stage with the marker on his face, and yeah. I was like,
and in the poster, it's so dark that it looks like blood.
Yeah, exactly.
But it is not. And for many years, I had sort of misremembered that scene, and always thought that was blood. I don't know why I misremembered that scene, but. It was, some dude was just writing on him with a magic marker while he was completely obliterated on on whatever drugs he was taking.
It's weird how everything becomes quaint after 35 years.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Like, you look at these guys, oh, the punks. Yeah. I just want to give you a... But, you know, X was amazing. Dave and I were talking afterwards, and I said that, like, if they'd been born a few decades earlier, that I could have seen John and Xene singing Bertolt Brecht.
Yeah.
You know, they just...
Well, as the discussion went on, I corrected you and said that basically they would be a country duo.
Yeah, but... Yeah. Okay, but I don't think the 40s or 50s would have been ready for their brand of... You know, they would have had to actually hit the notes.
Okay, yes. She would have needed to be a better singer.
She's a great singer for what she does.
A better technical singer.
Right. I mean, Kitty Wells was not going to be
singing.
She's
an incredible intuitive singer.
Yes.
And her ability to freak harmonize with him is I mean, for the past 35 years, they've done it, and they are unparalleled. Like, you don't hear anyone else but them when you hear them. You know exactly who that is. They are the George Jones and Tammy Wynette of that thing.
It's like they're juggling chainsaws at each other blindfolded and still always know when to catch them.
Yeah.
You know, it's thrilling to watch.
And so, but yeah, what's really the thing you say that it's, you know, quaint is that the liberation aspect of we could swear because nobody wants us on their record label.
Right.
We get to do exactly as we please. Mm-hmm. And we're going to say the F swear all the time. All the time. And
no and one it, has a gun in this movie.
And it's going to be shocking to a lot of people who see it.
Right.
They're going to say, how are musicians getting up there and saying bad swears? You know? So, I cannot emphasize enough just how important that film is to me in terms of sort of showing me an open door to this other place where I could escape the thing that I was in.
Right.
You know, aka the church. Punk rock taught me how to think.
Hmm.
And it gave me options for where to run to next. So, yeah. Although I will say this, Fear, they were a crappy band. Catholic Discipline, not interested.
But Frank in a suit? But
Frank in a suit, she, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Alice Bag, I feel the same way. Not interested. I was a hardcore kid.
In the middle of the Alice Bag really? Song, I turned to Dave and I said, don't tell me, they all went to CalArts.
Maybe.
They struck me as a very kind of like...
arch.
They saw Talking Heads once, so we're like, oh, we can do that.
Yeah, well, that was the great thing about it. You did see them and think, oh, we could do that. You know. And honestly, once the Germs had come along, the idea of you can do that is...
Sure.
Yeah, yeah, you can.
You don't even need the three chords. You don't have to play these instruments at all.
Yeah, you just like, bah, 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 and have someone get up there and be drunk and go, there you go, you're a band.
I know, I wish Darby Crash had lived long enough to do a cover of Hate the Sport.
I would like to know, from anyone who might have any information, why we never see a single go-go, okay?
Hmm.
Because not only were the Go-Go's part of that first wave,
right?
That Canterbury Mask.
Oh, Black Flag. That's who we forgot.
No, I said Black Flag.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah. Not only were the Go-Go's part of that first wave of Hollywood punk where they all played at the Mask and all lived at the Canterbury Apartments across down on Cherokee.
Mm-hmm.
Belinda Carlisle was an original member of the Germs.
Right.
Okay. And she, you don't see her. Hmm. Never do. You see a woman who looks ish like her.
Yeah.
But it's not her. Hmm. From my perspective that I can tell. Off in the crowd, you know.
Maybe they were mean to Penelope.
There were five. I'm wondering about that. That's what I'm wondering about. Did someone hate Penelope Spheeris or did Penelope Spheeris
hate them?
You know, because there were five of them. Six, if you count Margot, who was, you know, who left or got kicked out or whatever. Right. None of them. Well, not a peep.
If you hadn't made us bolt for the Q&A, we could have asked.
Why do you hate Belinda Carlisle? That, actually, you know, we should have stayed for the Q&A. So, you know, that would not have been a question that anyone
Anyway, but it's great that this is finally coming out as a box set. Decline to the Metal Years is fascinating because it's grotesque and absurd and you're not sure if you should be laughing at it or weeping for them or what, but between just like Ozzy Osbourne at his pre-rehab messiest and all of these sort of wannabe rock stars that she interviews, and she asks every single one of them, well, what are you going to do if you don't make it? And they're all, oh, I'm going to make it. I'm totally going to make it. Oh, no, that's going to be me. I'm going to make it. It's must viewing. And then Decline 3 is real just depressing.
Incredibly depressing.
Because it's just all about homeless kids in the punk scene in the, you know, what, in the 90s. But worth looking at, you know, once.
I saw it in the 90s when it came out.
Yeah.
You showed it at the festival.
Right.
Did you just say that?
No, I didn't.
Okay. And it just made me incredibly sad.
Yeah.
Because it's about these just desperate homeless kids.
Yeah.
In Hollywood. And the bands that they liked. And the band, I don't know that any of those bands, you know, really went on to
go anywhere.
Yeah, it's a tough sin. Yeah,
but
yeah.
One and two, yeah. Must viewing. Yeah. My DVD pick this week is the Blu-ray of Five Easy Pieces that Criterion is putting out. It was originally part of a box set for the company that put all these out, and I'm blanking now on the name of it. But anyway, now you can buy Five Easy Pieces separately, and it is one of my favorite 70s movies when people talk about the kind of films that the early 70s Hollywood was about, these sort of, you know, interesting auteurist character pieces. It's Jack Nicholson, Bob Rafelson. Nicholson plays a blue-collar oil derrick worker, and he gets word that his father is dying, so he goes home, and you find out that he comes from this very privileged background that he's been sort of trying to escape. And it is really powerful and one of Nicholson's great performances. This is the movie that has the infamous chicken salad diner scene in it. Karen Black is really good in it. I think she got an Oscar nomination. Excuse me. Karen Black got an Oscar nomination for it, I think, as did Nicholson. Have you seen Five Easy Pieces?
I never have seen
Five Easy Pieces. Oh, man. We have to watch Five Easy Pieces. It's so great. So, yeah. So, that's coming out this week. I highly recommend it.
Okay. I just found the answer to my question.
Oh, do tell.
An interview with the L.A. Record with Penelope Spheeris.
Uh-huh. At the L.A. Record, was this from 1980? We haven't had an L.A. Record in a long time, as I recall.
June 23rd, 2015.
Oh, then I don't know what the L.A. Record is. Okay, never mind.
Okay, well, anyway. Here we go. The question is, why did you shoot the bands you did? The criticisms I often see of the first decline are about who was left out. No weirdos, no screamers. And she says, I would have loved to have the weirdos and the screamers in there and plenty of other bands of that time. A lot of it just came about because during the times we had the cameras, those bands happened to be available. We were shooting film. It wasn't like you could just run a video camera that keeps going and you're not paying for it. I was shooting music videos at the time as a way of making my living. I had a company called Rock and Reel way before MTV.
For whom was she making music
videos? So whenever I had the equipment, I'd go, okay, where can I go and shoot this band? It was just a matter of convenience as opposed to, oh my God, the Germs are the best of every punk band in the whole wide world. The Go-Go's were supposed to be in the movie. But they crapped out at the last minute, and I'm glad. Because they turned into a bubblegum band.
Oh.
Margot Go-Go, also known as Margot Olivaria, was in the Go-Go's. She started it. That's when we were talking to them about the movie, and then they kicked out Margot. And it sort of became taken over in a commercial way. It didn't feel right. The funny part is, years later, they wanted to. What did they want, Anna, her daughter? They wanted to use decline footage of the crowd shots to show that that's where the Go-Go's came from. Which is true. They did. They used to open. Go-Go's used to open for Black Flag. Like, that's how rough they were at the beginning.
Right.
And then Jane Wedlin and Charlotte Caffey were like, oh, by the way, we can write songs. Like, we do write pop songs. Would you like to hear some of them? Yeah. The A&R people, when the A&R people came and all the other bands were like, we're going to urinate on you, the Go-Go's were like, yes, you have money for us, maybe? We have these pop songs that we have written. We got rid of Margot.
4-4 time.
Yeah, I didn't know they'd kicked Margot out.
Mm.
Well,
I could see,
sad.
I could see where somebody from Penelope Spheris' perch would look at the Go-Go's as being sellouts, but, you know, bless them.
All right, some letters.
They sold out awesomely.
They sold out really well. Pause it for a moment, will you, so I can dig up these letters?
Sure.
While we were paused, you were singing Our Lips Are Sealed.
Yes.
You were singing the Jane Bridge.
Yes.
Yeah. It was not bad. Yeah. I like it when you sing to me.
Yeah. It wasn't
I'm glad you didn't do it on the mic, because as we said last week, yes, I'm the singer.
Yes, you're the singer. I'm the DJ, right?
Yeah. Jerry says, "Dear Alonzo." Oh, I'm sorry. Subject line of this email. De La Renta Evangelista. "Dear Alonzo, thank you for yet another drag queen name that made me LOL on the bus. I want someone to have that name."
It's yours for the taking. I'm not planning on on subsuming the identity of De La Renta Evangelista. She belongs to the world.
Dynamoxy. Hello, Dynamoxy.
Hey.
This is friend of the show, Dynamoxy. Yes. Hello. I wanted to let you both know that today I pulled a full Peggy Olson and skipped work to go see Dope.
Nice.
Technically, I should have been on the schedule for today, but was not. So instead of going home, I walked to the movie theater 2 blocks away and then walked another block away to a coffee shop to sit for an hour because movies start at 11:30 a.m., not 10 a.m. But then later, I saw Dope. It was great. I felt like I and the 6 other people in the theater really made a difference. 2 points. You failed to mention the rapper ASAP Rocky. Did we fail to mention him?
I know I mentioned him on What the Flick. I might have forgotten to mention him here. He's the drug dealer guy. He's very good. I don't know him as a rapper, but he's a compelling screen presence.
I mostly know him from the saga of interactions between him, the rapper Danny Brown, and the person Kathy Griffin. But he was but he was really great in this. They were on her show when she had the talk show. Remember when they were on the show? They were just messing with her the whole time.
Oh, no, I missed that, I guess.
Also, you failed to mention the totally morally ambiguous ending. Well, that's because we didn't want to give away the ending.
Yeah, you know. This isn't Popcorn Mafia.
unless this...
Well, they remember the beginning of the show. It said, so if you don't like spoilers, forget about it.
Right.
So they gave everything away.
Unless this was another example of the sometimes flawed tone, I totally wasn't sure how I was supposed to feel walking out of the movie. I felt good. I felt good for him.
There is a certain moral ambiguity.
He did what he had to do to get what he needed to get.
Sure, yeah. You know? I mean, yeah. You can look at it in a sort of a pragmatic phase, or that he has, you know, stepped into the dark side. I don't know. There's a lot of ways to look at it.
He was just stepping into Christmas.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. I am looking for the next letter. Hang on just a moment, please. Where did it go?
Now I've got Step Into Christmas stuck in my head. Which, by the way, I always think that I'm the only Christmas weirdo around, but somebody on our block yesterday was jamming out the party tunes, and 3 of them, over the course of a few hours, were Christmas carols. I don't know if it was just they were using an old playlist and didn't bother updating it from December, but it was like, why am I hearing Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree in June?
Okay, this is from Carol. Carol Ann.
Go into the light.
Yeah,
Carol.
Yeah. How many times do you think she's heard that joke? Yeah,
never. I've wanted to be the first.
Dear Alonzo and Dave, this is my 3rd letter, but 1st question
for you guys.
A couple of weeks ago on Malton on Movies with Baron Von Leonard. With Baron Von.
Yes.
You need to put commas in your emails, Carol Ann. Leonard had his daughter on talking about 3 movies that changed her life. The episode sparked me to ask all my friends this question. And now I ask you both. Personally, I've thought about this a lot. My 3 are Dogma, Amistad, and Batman and Robin.
Really?
Which all 3 I saw in the theaters. Dogma made me question religion.
Okay.
But also was my first introduction to Kevin Smith and to what my mom calls that type of humor. I grow up with G-rated and slapstick comedy, so I find a movie and creator who said the F-word, A-word, and all the other words that my mom hates, and it was magic. It showed me you can be smart and tasteless at the same time. Amistad was the first movie I really cried in, and still cry when rewatching. I grew up with a mom who cried at every other movie, even the ones she'd seen before, and I never understood why until I saw Amistad. That flashback on the slave ship gets me every time. Yeah. Batman and Robin, I know, is an odd choice, but it was the first movie I saw and thought, this is bad. This is what probably started my bad movie obsession. Mm. I remember leaving the theater thinking, that was awful, but I kind of liked it.
That is a key turning point. I think I know I've talked before about going to see when I went to see The Lonely Lady in theaters. It was the first movie that I went to go see knowing this is going to be terrible. Right. I got to go see it.
Right. My honorable mention is My First Mister. But Leonard Maltin's daughter, Jessie, summed it up better than I could about why that movie was important to girls who felt or maybe looked like a weirdo to the world. Now it's your turn. I can't wait to hear what movies shaped your brilliant minds. First of all, this whole wave of My First Mister love is baffling to me.
I never saw it. You hated it.
Yeah, do I have to go back and look at it again? I mean, like,
Is this like a goth girl thing?
Maybe. That might be, maybe, possibly.
I've never seen it, so I don't know.
Well, you know what? I've talked about these films on this show, The Poseidon Adventure.
Right.
This is my first grown-up movie when I was like seven. And the one I just mentioned, Decline of Western Civilization. And as far as bad movies go, that was Airport 77. Mm. That was the first one I saw where my oldest brother had taken me and he was mocking the film openly. We were virtually alone in the screening room. I don't remember there actually being any other people in the screening room. In the movie theater, I mean. I'm talking about screening rooms, like the ones we go to for movies.
Right.
And he was laughing during the film and saying funny stuff to me, and I was 12 going on 13.
Yeah.
And it was this moment where I thought, a movie can be bad and you can laugh at it, and then when it's over, you've actually still had a good time.
Right.
Because I'd seen movies that I thought were bad before. You know, I'd seen movies as a kid that bored me and I was stuck in them. You know, because I didn't know you could walk out.
Right.
But that was the first one I saw that was bad, where I thought, oh, bad movie can still equal awesome time at the movies. Yeah.
Hard for me. I mean, I would say, it's tough to say. I mean, I've seen so many movies.
Say it.
No, I mean, I'm just trying to sort of nail it down to things that really, I mean, I remember sort of growing up, again, I've told the story about my brother Fernando's movie books, you know, and like reading, say, you know, Donald Spoto about a specific Hitchcock movie and then watching that movie and looking for the things that he had pointed out and blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, the summer between my junior and senior year of high school was when I took my first film course.
Yeah.
And that was such a mind blower in terms of really going deep into these movies and analyzing them and, you know... Like I remember having to write a whole paper. It was a shot by shot analysis of the last 2 minutes of How Green Was My Valley. You know,
right?
But like that was the summer that I saw Sunrise for the first time, and I saw Rules of the Game for the first time, and you know, Written on the Wind, and all these movies that you know, Chronicle of a Summer, like that completely, you know, blew out my concept of what movies even were or could be. So
yeah.
I'd say collectively that summer really and. And that was the summer that changed everything. and I would also probably have to say Morris.
Oh, yeah.
That was probably the first time that I saw... It was the first movie that I saw with my first boyfriend that was a gay movie that didn't make me want to blow my brains out. Like, I had seen My Beautiful Laundrette before that. I had seen some other films that were actually, like, sexy and positive and all that stuff, you know. But I just remember going with my first boyfriend to see Morris on campus at Vanderbilt and just, like, looking at the movie and not having to hide how I felt about the movie and looking at him. And it was just like, that was a moment, you know, where I felt like I had stepped over a line as opposed to, say, seeing Prick Up Your Ears with Kurt Holman and having to be like, oh, God, don't say anything. Don't do anything.
Exactly.
You know. So, yeah, those would be mine.
All right, we're done.
All right. Well, as always, we thank you for listening. And we are going to actually record the Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife episode about What's Up, Doc, this coming week.
Yes.
Yes.
It's scheduled. It's on the books. It's happening.
Happen. Yeah. So we will let you know what's going on with that.
No more procrastinationing.
Right. The moment that it goes online, we'll be announcing it on Facebook and on Twitter and all that stuff, and you'll be able to order your own copy for a mere $1.99. Just PayPal us at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. In the meantime, if you wanted to go back and get some of our previous commentary episodes for, say, Two for the Road or Josie and the Pussycats or Clue or The Poseidon Adventure or The Apple, again, $1.99, linoleumpodcast@gmail.com, and let us know where to email those. We want to thank Blue, as always, for our wonderful theme music, and you can find out more about him at bluetopia.com, BLEUTOPIA. Check out our friends on the internet, ChristyLemire.com, the B-Movies podcast with Bibbs and Whitney, The Schmoes Know, Malton on Movies, The Canon, and the Rotten Tomatoes podcast, Fat Guys at the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Film Spotting, SVU, The Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this show for free on iTunes, and please go leave us a review there. I forgot to check this week, see if anyone has since last time, but I hope you have, because the more positive reviews we get, the better placement we get on the iTunes podcast page. You can also stream the show for free at Stitcher Radio or thelounge.com and leave us positive feedback there as well. There's also an app to stream the show at our Facebook page, Linoleum Knife Podcast. If you've not gone over there to like us, please do. You can follow us on Twitter at linoleumcast. You can follow me at A Duraldi, A-D-U-R-A-L-D-E. Follow Dave at D Leland White, D-L-E-L-A-N-D-W-H-I-T-E. And again, and of course, you subscribe to our YouTube page. We've been posting some of our oldest episodes, and you can join the Linoleum Knife group page on Facebook to talk with other fans of the show about movies and whatever else. Again, our email is linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. And a quick reminder, if you are in Los Angeles, Outfest is coming up July 9th through 19th. Tickets are on sale now for everything at outfest.org. And we're very excited about the Hollywood Forever screening of 54, The Director's Cut. We've never done a screening at the cemetery before. It's going to be great. You cannot buy tickets at the door for that, so make sure you get them in advance. It's going to be an unforgettable evening. And so that's it. I can't believe this year is half over. That's bananas. But we'll be back next week with more, so we'll see you then.
Goodbye.